It is a continuing of Tom Matthews on 18 December, 73.
And it really...
Well, we missed that last sentence, so it allowed Stanley to...
To develop the preamps and crystal mixers and things like that to a very high degree of sophistication. It was that time when he developed all the equipment, or the basis for it anyway, that was then used up later in Owens Valley.
I see.
And for several years, his crystal mixers and preamp were just about the standard item around the U.S. They were used at NRL, and Green Bank, and various other places. Yeah, very, very good design. Well, anyway, as soon as the contracts had been let for the 90-foot dishes, land was acquired.
And so one of the dates, can you just give me?
Well, I gotta think about that one. I guess that one. Well, I'd really have to go back, but it must be essentially in 58. Does that sound right? End of 57, beginning of 58, yeah. Somewhere right in there. Yeah. Well, then I got involved, doing a little surveying, laying out a true north-south azimuth, and things like that. And so everybody, as a matter of fact, out there was involved with setting up the track system, mm-hmm. and also involved in building the, seeing that the dishes got built properly. Bolton was involved, we all were involved in various bits and pieces, manufacturing some of the equipment, the control equipment, or an actual placement of the panels and how to get them into a true paraboloid to the highest degree of accuracy. We solved all of those problems for ourselves, and we're working closely with the construction crew.
So the contractor didn't have experience in this sort of thing?
No, they're bridge builders. They were very, very interesting people to work with because they were real experts in what they were doing, all right, but they didn't know how to build things to the accuracy we were interested in.
Why was that, though? Because, like, the NRL 84-foot dish, which was about that same error, I don't think it was built in this fashion. It was built by Kennedy Corporation, and they built dishes. What was the difference?
Well, the firm, the lowest bid, came in from Blau Knox, which is a bridge builder, and they got the contract, and then we said, sure, we'll provide any of the other expertise that is necessary, and we did.
I see. They started off as now they're known as for being able to build dishes.
Oh, sure. But they learned the hard way. Oh, we had all sorts of problems because one of the crane crew that was hired, he swore up and down that he'd had this rather lightweight crane beefed up so that he could lift the heavy loads. Well, okay, they ran all the equipment up by railroad, and then they had to transfer it to a narrow gauge railroad that was still in existence then, ran up the Owens Valley, which they did. And we were right beside the tracks, and so they just drove, you know, less than a mile away, transferred it to a flatbed truck to transport the big polar axis, for instance, the declination tube, things like this. And the deck tube, which was a great, oh, I don't know how much it weighed, but anyway, it's about 6 feet in diameter or more, I guess, a little more than 6 feet in diameter. It's the biggest piece of the whole thing. It's prefabricated. So we picked it up off the train car, and the boom collapsed. And so one of the construction crew was actually the head man there. And he saw this thing collapsing, and of course he ran the other way when it was collapsing. But the damn thing reversed itself and followed him. So he had to reverse his field again. He almost got killed right then, but he managed to escape by just...
Good heaven.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, they fixed the crane up and kept on, same crew, and kept on building the thing, and the boom then collapsed a second time. no damage, luckily, in any of these times to anything that couldn't be fixed. And so they finally said goodbye to them and brought her some real big cranes. And just, you know, trying to skimp by. Yeah. That was the problem.
Maybe that was why they had the low bid.
Yeah, it was. So anyway, the dishes got built. And at that time, it was very interesting because nobody believed that you could work an interferometer over anything like that kind of distance, that many wavelengths baseline.
Now, what were you thinking of for operating frequency?
Well, 960 megahertz, and with a baseline of, about 1,000 feet was the longest baseline.
That's about 1,000 wavelengths.
So that's 1,000 wavelengths. And nobody really had made a being able to send out the LO and get back the IF and so on with the cables. They thought, no, it just wouldn't lock, that the cables would be too temperature sensitive and all sorts of things like this. And they weren't at all convinced that we could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And nor were Stanley or Bolton really convinced. Stanley in particular was not. Convinced at that time it could be done. He thought it was a good possibility, but it was a gamble.
No, but so who was saying that it could be done?
Well, Bolton really was carrying the ball at that point. He said, sure, it can. He said, I'll do it. And okay, he turned out to be right. But certainly Stanley had his misgivings.
Yeah.
And
Who, by the way, I'm not sure exactly who got the whole group started at Caltech.
Bolton. John Bolton.
No, but who brought him?
DuBridge and Greenstein brought him over, really.
So really Greenstein?
Yeah.
Who had a long association with theoretical side of radio astronomy.
Yeah, I guess it was Jesse who really was behind that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I want to talk to him because, of course, he did quite a bit in the early days.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you should because he really got into it early, as I'm sure you know.
Okay, but then The dishes got done, finished about when?
Well, they must have got finished around 58. Yeah, I can't remember the exact time, but somewhere in 58 at this point. I haven't thought about this for a long time. And started observing, and everything worked fine, so we did a quick survey. Bolton and Harris did a quick survey, as a matter of fact, which is the CTA list. Then there was a quick survey done of the galactic plane, and that was the CTB list.
Mm-hmm.
And the CTC list was a list of strong radio sources trying to make it relatively complete over the sky, extragalactic radio sources, which we started observing for accurate positions. And, it was a problem to try and work out the techniques to get accurate positions, right ascensions and decks, to the highest degree of accuracy, which involved, understanding the equipment and how things drifted, because there were drifts, and we had to correct for them, and to solve for the exact azimuth and altitude of the baseline, things like that.
Now, how are your problems different from those that have been worked on for really almost 10 years at Cambridge and on getting accurate positions?
Well, we were trying to do it to at least a factor of 3 or 5 more accuracy. The most accurate results that had come out at that point was a list by Elsmore at Cambridge, and he got some very good results with accuracies, so down around a few seconds of time, a minute or two of arc. And we felt that we could do better than that, and in fact did do better than that, factors of 3 to 5.
Was that that much better in terms of fractions of a fringe?
We had two things in our favor. One is that we had a much cleaner primary beam, a smaller primary beam, and relatively few, we had a possibility of several different separations, and so we could check ourselves And we found, of course, immediately that the 3C list had all sorts of load shifts in it. And cleaning out all those load shifts was one of the main problems. Finding out exactly where in hell the sources were to begin with, and then pinpointing them accurately. And so that went on for Right Ascensions, and it was out of the Right Ascension material that the first series of identifications of sources was done. We didn't really have very good declinations at that point, but the Right Ascension accuracy was enough to start identifying things like 3C295 and some of the more
interesting. What was the accuracy roughly?
Well, we could... Well, it depends very much on how much observing you've done on a particular source, right. Obviously. But we could certainly pinpoint things to a few tenths of a second of time, in Right Ascension.
These 3C lobe shifts you mentioned, was your group the first one to find these out?
Yeah.
Before?
Yeah.
And then presumably let Cambridge know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we kept a compilation of all of it. Well, there's a very, very high degree of... competitiveness between Cambridge and the group at Caltech and in Australia.
The Australians, of course.
And, well, I don't know, that's a long saga, and I don't know if you're going to get anybody to tell you all that.
Well, Hay has a...
I haven't read what
Well,
he
goes through this in some detail. He smooths it over as much as one can, but he does tell the basic story.
There's a lot of infighting, I know. Yeah. Hell, there's no good feeling between Mills and Ryle, and well, between Bolton and most of the group back in Australia.
Yeah.
He was essentially invited to leave, which is why one reason he went to Caltech, I guess.
Yeah, well, I don't want
to. He got his own back at him, I must say.
Well, I don't want to get into the dirt digging business,
but there's lots of
these things do affect the development of the sun.
They sure do. Because there was no great cooperation with Cambridge. I mean, sure, we found out that things were lobe-shifted, but we didn't bother to tell Cambridge about it particularly. We just came up with the new positions. And the thing that we had there, of course, was the availability of the 48-inch plates and the availability of people who were interested in making identifications using the 200-inch.
Right.
And Ryle was, you know, really very upset about the fact that we had a very close working arrangement with the optical people, whereas he did not.
He was interested in having
And he felt that he was being shut out, and in a sense, I guess he was. And there was quite a bit of bad feeling going around because of this. He felt it was an unfair advantage. Well, anyway, it worked out to providing us. Dewhurst had come over from Cambridge and had done some early identification work, had done some very good stuff, as a matter of fact.
Taking place specifically?
No, looking over the 48-inch Palomar Sky Survey plates. With the existing positions from the 3C Elsmore list and so on. He and Minkowski had done that initial survey and had come up with a number of tentative identifications, many of which were indeed quite right. They had identified in particular a lot of these dumbbell sources, you know, the galaxies with double nuclei.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that they are not really very prevalent. They're just highly recognizable, and therefore they were picked up easily. But they were, you know, a little less convinced that these other things, single galaxies and so on, were the right identifications.
That didn't look too unusual
No.
otherwise.
No.
Let me go back to load shifts. So the 3CR was done because of these, basically because of these load shifts.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, how did Cambridge find out, finally, and they recognized the need for a revision?
Well, I guess it was mainly through the results that we had got which did get fed back into Cambridge, mainly through personal contact. They did some of their own checking anyway. They had other systems. They used the Elsmore setup, which was using the cylindrical parabola against this outlying station in various north-south positions, and they used it as total power, and they used it as an interferometer, and they used it in every possible combination. And I'm trying to remember the girl who did a lot of that observing, and her work is really the basis for the
Neville?
3CR. That doesn't sound right.
And Neville?
She wasn't Neville then, I don't think, anyway.
Well, I think Neville and Ryle are the ones that did the synthesis of the North Pole area.
No, it was before
this
that.
Is before, yeah.
Well, can't remember. So, the identifications went on that, and when 3C-295, which we really didn't identify so much, it was a combination of Dewhurst and Minkowski and our own positions, it all sort of happened mm-hmm. to go into the same hopper at that point, and then that was identified. And Minkowski managed to get a spectrum of it. Okay, the great excitement, obviously. So, the next thing that...
It being by far the highest redshift.
Yeah, so I was out looking for higher redshifts, and so I said, aha, what are the characteristics of 3C-295? And it's a small diameter source and high surface brightness, so I looked for other small diameter sources of high surface brightness and made a list of them. And the list included 3C-48, 3C-196, 3C-273, all the quasars, all the bright quasars were in that list.
But no, were these all definite identifications?
They weren't identifications. They were things
within
that I wanted
the error
to look at to see if I could get an identification.
Which were in within the error...
No. I mean, this was just taking purely a look at the radio characteristics and drawing up a list of candidates for 3C-295 type objects, i.e. things that you would see at a great distance.
But small diameter and high radio brightness
is
what you meant.
Surface
I thought you were talking
brightness.
About high optical...
No. Radio
okay.
surface brightness. And it turned out that...
And that just meant unresolved, really. In effect, didn't it?
No, because we had the early Jodrell Bank.
Oh, that's right. That's true.
Diameters, yeah. And so yeah. We really had some idea about what the sizes were, even though we didn't know what the structure was.
Yeah.
And so I started looking hard at these objects and asked Alan Sandage to take me 200-inch plates of the best possible positions, which I had compiled from our own work and from the Cambridge work, and he did, and handed me the plates, and so I was looking at those and discovered 3C-48 as being the only object anywhere near the error rectangle, and it was an object that has this very faint extra fuzz around it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what gave it away, of course. And then Alan Sandage went back to take the first spectrum of it. And then Guido Munch took a spectra, Jesse Greenstein took a spectra. And at that point, you know, everybody jumped in on the bandwagon then.
But, I mean, after you came back with this fuzzy object, was Sandage... this is obviously a good thing, or was
well,
it
everybody,
you?
No, I
so
mean, we all thought it was a star. There was there was no pushing had to be done. There was no problem about that. Everybody thought it was a star at that point, and so the paper at the AAS meeting, which Sandage gave, was a joint paper with myself first, and then a whole string of other people, Bolton, and Sandage and Greenstein and Munch, and I don't know who else got in on it. Probably Minkowski, no, I don't think he left at that point. He was no longer on the staff. And So for a whole year or more, we thought it was a star. And, there were several other identifications that came relatively soon after that.
But this was even after the spectra had been taken, but the lines hadn't been identified.
No, the lines were there. We couldn't figure out any redshift. We just weren't game to try a very high redshift, and we weren't thinking the right kind of lines at all.
So, in fact, you thought you had a first real radio star.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, there was a case of scotch that was bet between Bada and Bolton on that one. And I don't know that ever got paid off.
But which way was which? I mean, who was betting?
Bolton said that he was going to discover the first star, radio star.
And why didn't Bada think that was...
nobody could understand it. So they're a little reluctant to
call it a star.
Call it a star. But anyway, that's what we thought it was to begin with. And, then the other identifications came in. A lot of galaxies were identified along at the same time. And I had a long list of identifications that I was feeding to Martin Schmidt. And he'd go and he'd take the spectra of them, and we'd get a redshift, and then we could start making some sense as to what the structure was, and the size of the objects, the total power, and so on. And as things progressed and we got better data, because at this point we also started to use the north-south interferometer baseline, and the first accurate declinations came out, and that was, of course, a big advantage. Where you could cut down the error rectangle by another factor of five or so.
Mm-hmm.
And that enabled us to make a whole lot of identifications, at least with the brighter, and fainter for that matter, radio sources. And so there were a lot of galaxies that were in there, and the quasars. I mean, the 3C48196, 286, 147, 273, of course, was identified by Hazard with the occultation results. I don't know why I never got around to identifying that one, but I guess, yes, I do, because we didn't have decent observations there. That's why. The observations just didn't happen to be very good at that particular section of the sky. This is always the problem.
I have talked to him about that, so I know that story.
Yeah. And so as soon as that got identified, and Martin jumped immediately on that to get a spectrum of it, and it took him a few days to figure out what in heaven's name was going on there with the bomber lines. Have you talked to him?
No, I haven't. No, that's... I should do that, right. But why was 273 necessary? I mean, why not 48 and so forth?
Well, because 273... is again obviously one of these things. It has the extra jet, but it's still star-like, but the redshift is much, much smaller, and therefore Martin picked it up because he saw all the bomber lines.
All the others said they were much higher redshift.
Yeah, and usually only had one or two lines in them. Okay. In fact, 3C286 doesn't have any lines. It's one line, I guess.
I see.
And there isn't a good redshift for it even now.
So really, there was a period of, how long was it, a year and a half?
It was about a year and a half before...
I was waiting for a quasar of low enough redshift to come along.
Right.
You could see a pattern.
We needed one.
Yeah.
And then as soon as 273 had a redshift, then 3C48, we knew that redshift in a matter of hours. Jesse Greenstein and I jumped on that one in a hurry.
Yeah.
And then it was obvious the sort of thing that we were looking for.
But let me ask, were there any published papers in the when you thought it was a radio star stage that was this?
Yeah, the paper by myself and Sandage on the four objects that were identified took a long time to write, but indeed that was written when we still thought they were stars. And so we have a table in there which says, all right, if it's at this distance, here are the parameters and what they, total energy, magnetic field, and so on. And here are the multipliers, depending on which distance you care to assume.
Right.
And so there it is.
Yeah.
And we still thought they were stars. And the identification 273 came out. Well, that one was, I guess, still in press.
And that was 64?
That was real 63 was the, was when 273 was identified. And then things, well, that sort of, everybody was interested in that, and Ryle had got some good positions and was communicating them privately to Sandage, and then there was a lot of hard feeling in there, I'm afraid. Everybody felt that they'd been misused. As far as the Quasars are concerned, everybody was trying to get glory out of it, and there was an awful lot of backbiting and fighting with various people. Very unpleasant, as a matter of fact.
I guess basically because there's only one 200-inch when you come right down to it.
No, well, there's one 200-inch, but everybody wanted to have the glory of finding out, you know, Quasars and all the rest of it. It was the big thing, and everybody jumped on the bandwagon and tried to get whatever they could out of it.
But if there had been more instruments that you could have worked with, then you have competition rather than really stepping on somebody, because there's only one person that can end up, perhaps anyway, having final access.
Well, there's a tremendous pressure to, you know, find the highest redshift. I mean, everybody at that point really did think that these things were cosmological, to begin with, anyway. And the push for the highest redshift was fierce. And Martin...
It really hasn't ended yet.
It's still there. I don't know. I think one plays it down a little bit more now.
Well, I think it's been renewed recently. Once again, Hazard's showing that...
quasars are 5 seconds apart.
Yeah, we need to look for red objects now.
Oh, I see what you mean.
We could find a whole new set of very high redshifts.
Yeah. Well, that was fairly obvious a number of years ago that possibility existed. A very real possibility. And the Bologna group, of course, are the people that have sort of pushed that as much as anybody. At least you have to take infrared plates, which nobody is really willing to do because they're a devilish thing to handle with the hypersensitization. But, okay, you can do it that way.
Well,
or if you have highly accurate positions, you can just say, okay, this is the only object it can be.
I'm digressing here. Back to 64. So then what was the... So there was obviously this intense time of trying to find more quasars and understand. What were you doing specifically...
Well, I was doing the identifications. I was using the positional data that we had and doing the identifications and feeding the suggestions, looking at the plates, the 48-inch plates, getting accurate optical positions and making identifications and feeding them to Martin Schmidt, who then got the spectra and came back with redshifts when they were identified.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out very well and produced a fair length of galaxies identified and a fair number of quasars. And then I was, at that point, I started to look at the galaxies themselves to see what kind of galaxies these things were. And one of the nice things, of course, being at Caltech is that everybody comes through. And I looked at the galaxies and I started wondering what in the hell they were. And I happened to be reading Morgan's papers on classification system of galaxies that he proposed. And I noticed that a lot of these things were D-galaxies. And I didn't understand what he meant by D-galaxies, so I asked him, and he was there. So I asked him one day at lunch, and... he came back with me, and we started looking them over, and he got terribly excited, and so we did this paper together. And since we were using a lot of the identifications that Martin Schmidt had made, we called him in too, essentially after the paper had been written, practically, to put his name on it, which he was happy to do. But that was the basis of that particular paper, was just looking over all the identified objects to see if we could make any sort of rhyme and reason out of them.
It really was not until then the Caltech observations that there was anywhere near a sample of identifications other than
you know, so that we had good enough positions that you didn't have to look for objects that were really too peculiar.
Right.
And that was the big breakthrough. And, well, we did pretty well in the sense that there weren't very many false identifications that ever came out of that. There still are one or two that I don't think are right. 3C66, for instance, is one where things are too messed up. There's an extra strong source there, and I don't think we have the right identification yet. We may have for part of it, but it's not obvious for the whole thing. And 3C40, is the other one where I'm wondering whether we really do have the right identification even now. But nobody's come up with any better one at this point, so there we are. But that's a whole new class of galaxies then. The galaxies where Morgan all of a sudden said, well, okay, I call some other things like M31 a D galaxy. To hell with that. Let's change the classification scheme.
Right.
And so then that's what happened. That's what people got confused about, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
They say, well, look, M31's a D galaxy too. And, well, that was before he changed it.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
Be a strong radio source everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I think that takes me up to about the time where I'm sort of ending the history. It begins to just
then it
explode too much after 65 or so, in the modern era, so to speak.
Yeah.
Unless you can think of some other comments you might like to make on any of these matters.
Well, I certainly think that the one of the persons that you really ought to talk to is Minkowski, if you have a chance.
Oh, yes, I plan to.
And because he was in on a great deal of the initial stuff, and Bada, of course, was too. Bada unfortunately retired, went to Australia, and then came back and died. And that was a real great blow, because he was a fantastic person to talk to and to try out ideas on. I could sit and argue with him for hours. I mean, on a cloudy night in the 200-inch dome, I used to really sit and talk to him for hours at a time. And he'd tell stories.
Yeah, I've heard about his storytelling ability.
Oh, fantastic. But also, one learns a hell of a lot of astronomy in talking about these things, too. And talking to Bada and Minkowski, I think I really got more astronomy training than I did ever at Harvard.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
That ends the interview with Tom Matthews at Maryland on 18 December 73.